A great American president, Abraham Lincoln, said that his country was the last best hope of Earth, a nation with a special mission to save mankind. I'm Professor Adam Smith, director of the Rothermere American Institute at Oxford, and on this podcast, I'll be exploring how this powerful idea shapes America.
Tonight, with a full heart and deep gratitude for your trust, I accept your nomination for the presidency.
40 years ago, a twinkly-eyed president ran for re-election, trumpeting his economic achievements and fending off concerns about his age. And there, the comparisons to 2024 stop. Ronald Reagan won 58.8% of the popular vote and 525 electoral college votes. It was the last time an election was decided in a landslide.
Welcome back to our election coverage. The polls have just closed in 16 states. Ronald Reagan has won 12 of these new states. Walter Mondale won one.
His opponent, former Vice President Walter Mondale, won the Electoral College votes only of the District of Columbia and his home state of Minnesota, and even that only by a tiny margin.
I see America coming together.
Reagan's campaign claimed that America was entering a new era, recovering from a long malaise, the years of Vietnam, Watergate, and the drift of the Carter administration. It was summed up by perhaps the greatest campaign ad of all time.
It's morning again in America. And under the leadership of President Reagan, our country is prouder and stronger and better.
The Reagan campaign's dramatically successful embrace of a sunny American exceptionalism is the most memorable aspect of the 1984 election. But it was not the only reason why 1984 is worth remembering 40 years on. This was the last time a presidential nomination was determined at the convention, when Walter Mondale prevailed over the insurgent Colorado Senator Gary Hart, who'd won almost as many delegates in the primaries, including in the final primary in California, just as Bobby Kennedy had done in 1968 on the day before he was assassinated.
I think the American people want leadership, they want purpose, they want direction, they want problems solved.
4 years later, in 1988, the bouffant-haired Hart's career imploded over allegations of extramarital affairs. But in 1984, he blazed a trail that Bill Clinton was later to follow, offering new leadership from a new generation, the baby boomers, with all the skepticism, individualism, and idealism that implied.
My constituency is the desperate.
The Democratic primaries also saw the first serious run for office by an African American, Jesse Jackson, who won a fifth of the primary vote. And after Mondale won with the help of the party establishment, superdelegates, he chose Geraldine Ferraro as the country's first ever female running mate. 1984 pitted Reagan's exceptionalism against the divided Democratic Party that was searching for a new identity, one that anticipated the changing demographics and cultural politics of the following 40 years, or, as the Republicans put it, was captured by special interest groups. Is the America of 1984 a now distant land, where the rules of politics were different? Or are there continuities and influences that help us to understand the politics of today? Well, joining me now to discuss Reagan, Mondale, and the Morning in America campaign are Bruce Shulman, William E. Huntington Professor at Boston University, who was the Harmsworth Professor of American History here at Oxford last year, and the author of many books on 20th century America, including a forthcoming volume in the Oxford History of the United States, and Dan Rowe, lecturer in American History at the Rothermere American Institute, and the author of the forthcoming State of Development, Preserving the American Economic Century in an Era of Anxious Capitalism, to be published next year by Columbia University Press. So, one of the reasons why 1984 is so memorable is because it was such an incredible landslide victory of a kind that's now pretty unimaginable in today's politics. But that doesn't mean that the outcome was preordained in some way, does it? I mean, given the state of the economy and the Republican losses in the 1982 midterms, should we think about this as a sort of comeback victory for Ronald Reagan? Bruce, what do you think?
Absolutely. Not only was it not foreordained, but I think from the point of view of the fall of 1982, just 2 years before, it would have seemed almost impossible to imagine a Reagan landslide 2 years later. Not only were economic conditions bad, with unemployment approaching its highest levels since the Great Depression, with major American corporations like Chrysler and International Harvester seemingly teetering on the edge of bankruptcy, but also, you know, Reagan so unpopular that one of Reagan's closest advisors, his national security advisor, William Clark, someone he had known since his California days, comes to him and says, "Don't run for re-election, that you have accomplished so much already in changing the terms of debate in American political life, that if you lose the election, which it looks like is likely in 1984, that will just undermine what you've done. So why don't you withdraw now and declare victory?"
What we remember often about Reagan is this sunny optimism. He seems like this genial, nice guy. But there's a darker side to Ronald Reagan as well, which was perhaps much more visible to those who had grown up with Ronald Reagan, who'd seen him as California governor, who'd seen him as the insurgent candidate within the Republican Party in the 1970s. I mean, there was real fear of nuclear Armageddon, that there would be an accidental war essentially created by the fact that Reagan just wasn't having talks with Moscow, that the arms control negotiations that had been going on for the preceding 10 years or more had essentially ground to a halt, not perhaps solely because of the position of the Reagan White House, but during those early 1980s, it seemed like the Cold War was as frozen as it had ever been.
And there were moments, both serious and now in the rearview mirror, almost comical seeming, that sort of dramatized that sense that nuclear Armageddon might be near, and that Reagan was an extremist who didn't really understand the realities of that. So, of course, most famously, his 1984 caught on a live mic that he didn't know was live, sort of practicing his voice levels by saying that, "I have just signed legislation banning Russia. The bombing begins in 5 minutes." He had to walk that back. There was an incident in which it was revealed that the Soviets had been concerned about some U.S. war games that had laid out what a nuclear war scenario might be, that they had taken it seriously. Reagan said, "Well, we would never launch a first strike, so why would they take it seriously?" Not really seem to understand the level of tension. And of course, both in the United States and around the Western world in that early 80s period, there is a lot of popular uprising against Reagan's intensification of the Cold War. So opposition to the placing of new intermediate range nuclear missiles in Western Europe. There are major demonstrations in Britain and Germany. There's the nuclear freeze movement in the United States, where there's huge gatherings, including one in the Hollywood Bowl in Los Angeles, where Reagan's own daughter speaks out against his management of the Cold War.
Yeah. So it's this idea that he's just not intellectually capable. There's concern about his age, and all of this in the context of an economy that's really struggling. So let's talk about the Democratic Party then, before we get into the heart of the election. The Democrats had spectacularly lost the 1980 election, of course, to Ronald Reagan. They'd had this one-term president, Jimmy Carter, who had offered a different, at least a different kind of vibe from the FDR, LBJ style of New Deal politics. But it appeared to have been a failure, right? Carter had failed in his re-election bid in 1980. And so let's talk about the three main, there were others, but let's talk about the three main contenders for the Democratic nomination, because in a way, these three figures handily represent different strands of the Democratic Party. I'm thinking of Walter Mondale, who was the eventual winner, Gary Hart, and Jesse Jackson. Let's just do some quick thumbnail sketches of these three figures. Dan, who was Walter Mondale?
So Walter Mondale's this longtime Washington insider. He's been elected to the Senate for Minnesota in the 1960s. One of his mentors during that time has been the former Vice President Hubert Humphrey. So Walter Mondale, he comes from this quite unionized state, particularly unionized for auto workers, but also farm workers as well. He's in some ways sits at least reputationally within the old guard of the 1960s Democratic Party.
And 1960s Democratic Party, you say, Dan, but in a way that's the 1930s Democratic Party as well, right? Isn't that, so that's a core constituency of the Democrats since the New Deal era. So by this stage, you know, for more than half a century.
Absolutely. This core Northeast, Midwest, unionized, predominantly white working class industrial workers.
And he'd been Carter's vice president, so he'd been in the public eye, but he was offering something rather different from Carter, as is often the way, indeed, with running mates. I mean, Carter was this governor from Georgia who was running kind of against the establishment. You know, he'd never been to Washington before, as it were. I mean, not literally, but that was his kind of shtick. But in contrast, Mondale is the insider. He's the establishment guy, right?
Yeah, that's his reputation. I think actually quite interestingly for us, that's not the campaign that he ends up running, but that's certainly how he's known and thought of. He's not, in a way, he's not closely tied to the Carter administration, despite being, as you said, a prominent figure within the Carter administration, in part because of this previous reputation and career, which seems to sit quite differently.
Bruce, tell us about Gary Hart.
Gary Hart maybe represents as far away as you could be in the mainstream Democratic Party from Walter Mondale in the 1970s and 1980s. He's of a younger generation. He is indeed a baby boomer. He has got the hair and the good looks of a Kennedy, if not exactly the charisma and speaking ability, or at least not the same kind of speaking ability. He cuts his teeth in the 1972 presidential election, serving as the campaign manager for the insurgent campaign of George McGovern. This is the anti-Vietnam War candidate. This is the candidate of the new politics, really trying to take the energy of the grassroots social movements, the counterculture, the anti-war movement of the late 1960s and turn it into a new political force. He will be elected to the U.S. Senate from Colorado.
Not a state where you would expect a leading Democratic politician to have come from in the preceding decades.
And someone who represents that group of Watergate babies who come in the 1970s, representing states and areas that had not been traditionally sources of Democratic Party strength, the suburbs, for instance, places that have large percentages of college-educated people. So not the blue-collar industrial workers that we would associate, let's say, with Mondale's constituency. And Hart is very explicit about marking a generational and even an ideological change from the Democratic Party of the New Deal era.
Those of us elected in the 1970s feel that the old solutions to this country's problems, whether they're economic or energy or environmental, are not working. I think the American people want leadership, they want purpose, they want direction, they want problems solved, they want answers, they want proposals, they want ideas. The American people will vote for a Democrat who does offer new solutions and new ideas. And I think uniquely among the candidates, I'm trying to do that.
Ronald Reagan had famously said that government is not the solution to the problem, government is the problem. Gary Hart is coming along in 1984 and saying the New Deal is over. Does that mean that part of what Hart was offering to the Democratic primary electorate in 1984 was a kind of politics that acknowledged that the era of big government was over, that they couldn't rely on federal government programs, which were the hallmark of what the New Deal state had offered? It was that the challenge that he was making to the Democratic Party?
Absolutely. I think that Hart also said that he had learned in part from Ronald Reagan. And so even though Hart was not embracing the unfettered free market in the way that Reagan at least did rhetorically, and in fact, still saw a quite active role for the federal government in American economic life. He was suggesting that the received wisdom and established policies of the New Deal era, the things that Democrats had been running on since the 1930s and through into the 1970s, the kinds of policies associated with Walter Mondale's mentor, Hubert Humphrey, that they no longer worked.
So on the one hand, he is conceding some ground, as it were, to the Reagan revolution, in inverted commas. He's acknowledging that the nature of political economy is shifting, that the scope of the federal government is not going to continue growing and is probably going to shrink. On the other hand, he's offering what we can now see in retrospect as being a culturally very distinctive, more, in quotes, progressive kind of politics, embracing environmentalism, embracing a new kind of sort of rights agenda that came out of the 1960s and 1970s counterculture. So on the one hand, moving to, perhaps you could say in crude terms, moving to the left. On the other hand, in economic terms, perhaps moving a little bit more towards the Republicans, more towards the right. Jesse Jackson, Dan, tell us about Jackson. This is a really remarkable campaign historically, isn't it? The first major campaign by an African American, significant campaign with a chance, I guess, of winning a major party nomination.
Yeah, I mean Jesse Jackson, this famous civil rights activist and leader from the 1960s, has sort of run, in a way, we might say, the anti-Mondale and anti-Hart campaign. He's run a campaign actually saying that his policy agenda is actually one of social welfare expansion, that in a way broadening government, seeing a role for government in delivering full employment. And how is he going to deliver those things if he's elected? Well, he's going to deliver those things through reducing the military, shrinking government by disarmament, and redeploying the government spending through that. He's also campaigned around issues that we might broadly group under the theme of anti-imperialism, anti-US involvement in Central America, and bringing in a lot of the activists and the grassroots activists who've become insiders in the Democratic Party through the course of the 1960s. It's a sort of campaign that is saying, this is your time to come together in this rainbow coalition of all different colors, and that we will secure and gain the rights that previously were available to white industrial workers, the key beneficiaries in a way of the New Deal era and afterwards.
We come together bound by our faith in a mighty God with genuine respect and love for our country, and inheriting the legacy of a great party. The Democratic Party, which is the best hope for redirecting our nation on a more humane, just, and peaceful course. This is not a perfect party. We are not a perfect people. Yet we are called to a perfect mission. Our mission, to feed the hungry, to clothe the naked, to house the homeless, to teach the illiterate, to provide jobs for the jobless, and to choose the human race over the nuclear race.
Part of this, of course, is articulating a strong anti-Reagan message too, that part and parcel of Jesse Jackson, in a way, is being an almost photo-negative of the Reagan campaign, that's sort of being bellicose in Central America against various supposedly communist-leaning movements, is pledging to shrink government, and shrinking government means shrinking spending on social welfare, and is also prominent in engaging in what we might call dog whistle racial politics, whether it's refusing to be anti-apartheid in South Africa, being against the Martin Luther King holiday.
So a lot of what Jesse Jackson was saying in 1984 has its echoes in the Black Lives Matter movement, in the campaigns to kind of to abolish prison, that sort of kind of left politics in America today. Is that right? I mean, can you see a direct continuity from Jackson to today?
Absolutely. I think we can draw direct continuity from Jackson's campaign in the 1980s to today. And in fact, I might even go a little further than that and say that in these three different primary campaigns, these three strands of the Democratic Party in 1984, that we can draw lines connecting them to the tensions within the Democratic Party in the 2020s. That, you know, there's the part of the Democratic Party represented by the Clintons, Bill and Hillary, that I think is in many ways the heir of the Hart campaign. There's the part of the Democratic Party that was represented through most of the ensuing period by figures like Joe Biden, which we can see the echoes of the Mondale campaign. And as Dan pointed out earlier, that even though we tend to associate Walter Mondale with the legacies of the New Deal, that maybe he was a little bit more complicated than that, and that his time as an understudy for Jimmy Carter had at least brought him to try to synthesize some of the new and old elements together in the way that Joe Biden is trying to do now. And then, of course, the Jackson campaign, I think, speaking to the crucial role of Black voters and other racial minorities in the Democratic Party coalition.
And thinking about the way that Mondale positioned himself to acknowledge the diversity of the Democratic Party, his running mate, Mondale, eventually won the campaign, and he won it with the help of the party establishment, with the superdelegates in the Democratic convention. But his running mate was Geraldine Ferraro, the first woman to be nominated on a ticket by a major party. Tell us about the significance of that, how it played out politically, and what that choice tells us about Mondale, because it was his choice, wasn't it? Dan?
Yeah, I mean, I think Ferraro, as you said, it's a groundbreaking historic moment, this selection of a woman to be the vice presidential candidate. Ferraro, in a way, represents something of that new generation that we've already spoken about, a 1970s generation of Democratic Party elected official. But also, she speaks to development within the Democratic Party itself during the course of the 1970s, which any listeners who've watched the HBO program Mrs. America might be somewhat aware of, the sort of rise of key women's rights activists to positions of prominence and power as insiders within the Democratic Party, people like Shirley Chisholm, Bella Abzug, also from New York, who've sort of tried to shape the Democratic Party platform, the policies, to introduce policies that they see as important, whether that's universal daycare and other things. But another part of Ferraro's selection is what was called at the time the gender gap. In the 1980 election, Ronald Reagan has run something like 10 points behind, 10 percentage points fewer women have voted for him than men. And this is a sort of major issue and point of discussion within both the journalist class, but also within the Republican Party too. If you go to Ronald Reagan's archives today, you can see folders and folders discussing how to do better at securing women's votes in the 1984 election. So the Ferraro selection is based on the recognition of several things at once. One is the idea, as ever with a vice presidential candidate, that it offers, the candidate themselves offers something that the top of the ticket doesn't, and offers an outreach to constituencies that it doesn't, but also a recognition, as I've said, of the political power and influence wielded particularly by women that have been elected to office and positions of prominence within the Democratic Party during the 1970s.
Now, in the end, Reagan wins in such a landslide that he does, in 1984, win a majority of the female electorate, because he wins a majority of pretty much every subdivision of the electorate apart from African-Americans. Maybe this is the cue to talk about the It's Morning Again in America ad, because, I mean, listening to you there, Dan, it occurs to me that one of the reasons why this campaign ad was so effective, or at least I assume it was effective. Maybe you two are about to tell me that, in fact, the data shows that it wasn't as effective as I assume it was, but I think it's a brilliant piece of political advertising. Maybe part of it is because it is very much focused on domestic issues. The campaign ad uses the metaphor of it being morning again in America with these images. I think it was shot somewhere in California, of a morning in America. Today, more men and women will go to work than ever before in our country's history, with interest rates at about half the record highs of 1980.
Nearly 2,000 families today will buy new homes, more than at any time in the past 4 years. This afternoon, 6,500 young men and women will be married. And with inflation at less than half of what it was just 4 years ago, they can look forward with confidence to the future.
The images that that accompany that, the mellifluous voice, the voice actually of the guy who wrote the ad and was in charge of the ad company that was contracted by the Republicans to run it. The images that accompany that narration are of young women, of an old granny kind of cuddling the bride after the wedding. It's quite domestic. It's about families. It's about prosperity. It's about ordinary Americans doing well. And it's impossible, I think, not to watch that advert and think, wow, what a great country to live in. And I'm not even American. Bruce, you may have had a different reaction when it came out. Tell us your view of the Morning in America ad.
Well, I think it is a remarkable ad. We can't say how effective it was because Reagan won by so much that, you know, the reasons for his victory are
I thought, over. Dan, you might be able to tell us that in the Reagan archives, there's some memo saying that they'd focus grouped it. In fact, it was a disaster or something. But that probably wasn't the case. Probably the opposite was true.
There are two really remarkable things about that ad. One that you alluded to, which is the way that it intercuts scenes of ordinary, everyday American life. People going to work, people going to school, people getting married, with the campaign message of, do you want to go back to where you were just 4 years ago, and taking credit for those changes. But it does it by presenting this picture of the wonders of ordinary middle-class American life. It's also very, very careful to include at least a few. It's mainly prosperous looking white faces, but there are a few brown faces in the ad as well. There's a close up on a young Latino boy in one of the scenes that we see. The other thing that I think is remarkable is that you don't hear Ronald Reagan's voice. You don't see Ronald Reagan's face until the very last second when it says that this has been, you know, produced by the Reagan campaign. And so it's sort of creating a vision of America that people, even those that don't particularly like Ronald Reagan, can join in and feel a part of.
Dan, was it helpful to the Reagan campaign that the 1984 Olympics were held in Los Angeles?
Oh, absolutely. And obviously, these sort of themes that we can see running through that ad of renewal, but also patriotism and national pride, right? A sort of clearly part and parcel of any Olympic event or Olympic opening ceremony. We only have to think, for British listeners, we only have to think of the sort of British exceptionalism that was wrapped into the 2012 London Olympics opening ceremony. But the fact that to redeploy the phrase from the 1960s, the fact that the whole world is watching, in a way, Los Angeles and these sort of the show and everything else and the themes that are usually bound up in Olympics, allows for this message to be that throughout the Morning in America ad, but also throughout campaign appearances, to be more broadly broadcast and in a less controlled, less overtly political way.
That was the opening ceremony in which there were 84 grand pianos playing Rhapsody in Blue, wasn't there?
But what was missing from those opening ceremonies and those Olympics is very important too. And that is the Soviet Union and the Eastern Bloc did the Reagan administration a favor by boycotting those Olympics. It was their payback for Jimmy Carter's boycott of the Moscow Olympics in 1980. But what it meant was that without the competition from the Soviets and the entire communist bloc, Americans won practically everything. So it was a 2 weeks of nonstop replaying of the Star Spangled Banner.
Of the national anthem and images of the flag. And 1984 was also Bruce Springsteen's Born in the USA, which the Reagan campaign kind of briefly tried to co-opt, despite the fact that Bruce Springsteen was not a Reagan supporter, of course. Dan?
Yeah, I mean, this is a perennial thing that happens, particularly with this Born in the USA song. The sort of elevating chorus and the way that Born in the USA is almost shouted at the listener sort of seems to echo, and the musical accompaniment seems to echo this national pride narrative. And this gets misinterpreted.
Even though that's not really, yeah. That's not really what the song's
about.
No, in
fact, the song's about the opposite, right? Like most of Bruce Springsteen's oeuvre from about 1978 to about 1984, it's about the fact that this blue collar life isn't available to people who might be like Bruce Springsteen growing up in New Jersey anymore. It's about the fact that being born in the USA for white blue collar workers didn't mean what it was supposed to mean and what had been promised. But it gets misinterpreted. It gets used in speeches. It gets talked about. Famously, the conservative George will go to a Bruce Springsteen concert and write a column in the summer of 1984 saying, essentially, well, I don't know what the young people around me were smoking because I wouldn't know what it smelt like.
Just the idea of George Will at a Bruce Springsteen concert is itself extremely amusing. There was one of many opportunities, it seems to me, that the Mondale campaign missed. I mean, the Mondale campaign should have been the Bruce Springsteen campaign, shouldn't it? In fact, what they did was to run a whole series of ads with really scary music. All of their ads seem to have really scary music underlying them, all with dire warnings that if you vote for Ronald Reagan, which by implication you are probably planning to do, you will regret it at some point in the future. Is that an unfair summary of the Mondale campaign on TV?
It's not an unfair summary. I think we have to remember that Mondale began his campaign with one of the greatest missteps in American electoral history. The first thing he said in accepting the Democratic nomination was that he was going to raise taxes.
Whoever is inaugurated in January, the American people will have to pay Mr. Reagan's bills. Mr. Reagan will raise taxes, and so will I. He won't tell you. I just did.
And what that? I mean, one of the missteps? How did he do that?
It's very hard to explain. But I think that he was trying to find an issue that would not only appeal to kind of loyal Democratic constituencies, but to the people that had voted for Jimmy Carter in 1976 and then voted for Ronald Reagan in 1980. And he fixated on the growing federal deficit as something that, on the one hand, he could use it to try to demonstrate Reagan's extremism and incompetence and out of touchness but so that that would appeal to core Democratic voters, but that would also, I think, appeal to swing voters who he thought would be interested in this model of fiscal responsibility, which of course had been something that Jimmy Carter had campaigned on in both of his elections, even if he didn't actually produce much in the way of fiscal responsibility. So I think there was some strategy there, even though it was very poor strategy as it came out.
After you work for a lifetime to pay off your house, you expect to be free and clear. But in another American house, there are plans today to put you $18,000 in debt, your share of Mr. Reagan's deficits. But when Mondale moves into the White House, he won't forget about your place. He'll cut spending, close tax loopholes, and put new taxes in a trust fund to pay off Reagan's debt. Let's stop mortgaging America. Mondale Ferraro, they're fighting for your future.
But I think what we see in the scary music and the relentless negativity of Mondale's campaign in 1984 is that the essence of their campaign was to paint Reagan as an extremist, somebody who is out of touch with the mainstream values of American people, someone who in his conduct of international affairs was bringing the nation to the precipice of nuclear war, and maybe bringing the world to the precipice of nuclear Armageddon. Those were things that a year or two previously had been part of the general public discourse. So they were not as, you know, so far out of it as they might have seemed now in retrospect. Also, Mondale had watched what had happened during the 1980 campaign when he lost to Reagan as Jimmy Carter's running mate. And in that campaign, in 1980, they had trailed Reagan substantially through most of the summer. But when they tried to turn the issue or the focus from the question of Carter's management of the economy to Reagan's fitness for office, they actually had some success. They narrowed his lead in the polls. Reagan had refused to engage in a presidential debate with Carter. He didn't need to. He thought he had such a lead. But that lead eroded enough that Reagan agreed to that one presidential debate they had the week before the election. It didn't go well for Carter, but Mondale had witnessed that. And so I think he saw that the way forward for him was to try to raise doubts about Reagan's fitness for office. That's why the age issue figured so largely in the campaign as well.
Reagan famously deflected the age issue, didn't he, in, I think, the second presidential debate.
I will not make age an issue of this campaign. I am not going to exploit, for political purposes, my opponent's youth and inexperience.
I will not count my opponent's youth and inexperience against him.
Was that perhaps one of the genuine vulnerabilities of the Reagan campaign, was the fact that he was 74.
If we want to be precise, I actually think he's 73. I think he's 1911.
February 1911.
Okay, yes, Let me. Sorry. So Reagan was 73. Let me ask the question again. Reagan was 73. He was going to be the oldest elected president if he won, up to that point, of course. So, Dan, was this age issue a genuine source of vulnerability for the Reagan campaign?
I think it was a source of vulnerability at a point in time, as Bruce has hinted at, where there aren't actually that many sources of vulnerability in a way that the Democratic Party has assumed that it's going, for most of 1983, that the election is going to be about the economy. And when the economy is performing, what seems to be performing well, that's taken an issue away that has seemed to be there. So one of the few remaining issues might be fitness for office in terms of age, and the fact that Ronald Reagan is seen and is talked about in newspapers and television as not having a good first debate, it does appear to have some impact on the polls, and it does seem to be an issue that can be used against Ronald Reagan. And as you've said, he is, from that point in time, comparatively old, but he's also someone who's been around in a way for a very long time. The movie that has made him, that has given him a lasting legacy and the nickname of the Gipper is a 1940 movie. So by 1984, he's really been a household name in lots of ways for 44, going on 44 years. So
he was very, very good at those one-liners, though, wasn't he? I mean, he was very good. He did. He was very good at every stage in his political career, so far as I can see. He was good at it in the 1980 campaign, and this example from 1984 is good at it. And that was part of his political success, wasn't it? Because there was a twinkle in the eye when he delivered those zingers, and people remembered them. And this was obviously before the age of social media, but it had that kind of social media clip value that people would remember that. It had kind of cut through, didn't it? That ability to deliver those one lines. And compared to Walter Mondale, or indeed compared to Jimmy Carter for 4 years earlier, who spoke in paragraphs, who probably had policy briefs prepped and all around them they could go to. But in the end, it didn't matter because that one zinger from Reagan undercut the value of any of that.
Yeah, Jimmy Carter not only didn't have that kind of ready-made eloquence and that ability to deliver the potent one-liner, he actually was personally and ideologically opposed to that kind of eloquence. He really thought that was, having grown up in the South, he associated it with a kind of demagoguery that he wanted to get the United States passed. And so that's why he had those incredibly boring, fact-laden, endless speeches. But what Reagan, at one point of his presidency, when he is asked about, you know, his career as a Hollywood actor before he got into politics, he said, having done the job of president, he couldn't understand how you could do the job and not be an actor. That learning, like how to hit your marks, when to deliver your lines, when to pause, when to speak, that all of that was such an essential part of the job.
That seems to me to speak to today, the problem in American politics today, because it seems to me the case for Joe Biden is that he's good at being president, as in getting things done, being on top of the brief, understanding how the government works, because he's been there for such a long time. The problem with Joe Biden is that he doesn't seem to be very good at appearing to be president and making the case for himself to be president. And maybe that's to do with his age. Maybe that's to do with his historic stutter. Maybe that's a lot of other things. But Ronald Reagan may not have been very good at being president, but he was very good at appearing to be president. And that is itself part of the job. I mean, he wasn't wrong about that, because if people are looking in this weird monarchical presidential system that you guys have over there, people are looking to the president for some kind of security and leadership and reassurance. And Reagan gave them that. I mean, that was a real thing.
Being able to communicate ideas is essential to the job. Being able to mobilize public opinion is essential to the job. They all depend on that set of skills. And I think really it was in that kind of leadership that Reagan excelled, much more so than in his policy achievements, which in both international and in domestic affairs, the record is one of a mixed level of some achievements and less. But certainly, I think it's fair to say that Reagan has to go down as one of the most successful presidents of the 20th century, whether you like or not the way he led or where he led the United States, because he really did change people's minds and change the ways Americans thought about American politics, what was possible, what was necessary, what was desirable. And I think that had enduring consequences in shaping the American political order.
When Reagan was young, his big political hero was Franklin Roosevelt. And it's impossible not to see the parallels there half a century later. And one of the parallels, of course, you know, Reagan was kind of perhaps bookending the era begun by Franklin Roosevelt. But both of them had a very similar kind of style and a twinkly personality and ability to talk to voters and the one-liners and everything you just said, Bruce, the ability to change the conversation, to attract whole new segments of the electorate and as a consequence to win in an unimaginably big way. So, I mean, question for both of you. I mean, in the end, how on earth do we explain then this huge, huge victory? Dan?
I think a big part of it, Adam, is purely the strength of the economy, the sense that a new era was beginning.
Are you then acknowledging that? I mean, I've already said I love the Morning in America ad, but I suppose I'd always assumed that, you know, there were two Americas in 1984 and the economy was booming for some people and it really wasn't booming for an awful lot of Americans in 1984. And so, you know, how much it, I mean, based on what you just said there, I mean, how much was that about perception, how much was that about reality? I mean, political scientists sometimes like to kind of say that we can explain everything about election results just by looking at key economic indicators. If you took that approach in 1984, would Ronald Reagan have won on that kind of scale?
I think so. And if you look at national indicators, it's possible to frame a positive national story. Now, we can zoom in on particular areas of the United States, the areas that we might call the Rust Belt, the former industrial regions of the United States where unemployment remains high. But from a national picture, it is possible to sell a message in 1984 that you are better off than you are 4 years ago. This Ronald Reagan in 1980 has asked this question rhetorically, are you better off than 4 years ago? And the large profits that major American corporations are making in 1984 makes this message possible. Now, I think another element of it too, is an element that perhaps makes this difficult to reproduce, but it is the lack of polarization to some degree within American society. The idea of somebody who self-identified or self-defined as a Democrat voting for a Republican was much more likely and much less of a big issue, both for voters but also nationally. That's almost definitely not the case now. That we know in the 2020s that even people who self-define as independents probably aren't independents if we ask them who they voted for in elections. But a very different party political space, even though we could draw some lines of continuity to it.
If you think of yourself as an American voter in the early 1980s, you've lived through a decade and a half of division, defeat, and decline. Division over the war in Vietnam, racial conflict, riots in the streets of cities, all kinds of evidence of a nation coming apart at the seams. You've seen defeat in Vietnam, which most Americans at the time, wrongly we historians know, but still have been told over and over again, was the first military defeat the United States had ever suffered. Deeply embarrassing, humiliating even, that the United States was no longer in this position of world leadership. And then decline after decades of post-war prosperity on an, you know, previously unimaginable level that had brought an entire generation of blue-collar working Americans into comfortable home-owning experience, sending their children to university. Then you had had the decade of stagnation and inflation and economic decline and American industry seeming to fall behind international competitors. And Ronald Reagan in 1984 told a credible story that had passed, that the United States had turned the corner, that it had recovered its glory, that it was standing tall again on the world stage, that it was renewing its prosperity and its world economic leadership. And in those cries of USA, USA at the Los Angeles Olympics and all of those televised images, that it was coming together as a nation in patriotic unity again. Now, that may have been very glib, that may have exaggerated some very real inequalities and very real differences of experience for many Americans. And let's remember, nearly 40% of Americans voted against Ronald Reagan, even in that landslide. But still, I think he could credibly say that he had reversed a decade and a half of division, defeat, and decline. And I think that is part of how we can explain the landslide in 1984.
As the ad says, under the leadership of President Reagan, our country is prouder and stronger and better. So why indeed would we ever want to return to where we were less than four short years ago? What lessons, if any, could we draw? If you two were advising the Biden campaign, let's say, are there any lessons you could look to 1984 and point to?
One thing is the reassuring positive tones of the campaign. We can think of those reassuring tones not just in Ronald Reagan, but also in Franklin Roosevelt, right? Even in the depths of the Depression, Franklin Roosevelt says, "You have nothing to fear but fear itself." He effectively says, "Trust me."
And runs with "Happy Days Are Here Again" as his campaign tune.
Yeah, so I think something in the positive framing, and especially for a president running for re-election and positively trying to sell what has happened during your term in office.
I would have thought that a rebooted Morning Again in America ad is exactly what the Biden campaign should be doing. They've got an economic story they can tell, which would probably sound very similar to the claims that could be made in 1984. What do you think, Bruce?
Well, they certainly could make that ad, and I suspect that they will make something like that. Certainly, I think it fits well with the temperament of Joe Biden, who is comfortable in speaking in terms that would be very familiar to Ronald Reagan, the talking about the uniqueness and the exceptionalness and the greatness of America, and how when Americans put their mind to something, they can solve any problem, and the unique role of the United States on the world stage. I think even his comfort in just using the term America to describe the United States kind of distinguishes Joe Biden from most younger Democrats in his party today.
That's such an interesting point, Bruce. Yeah.
Who are very reluctant to do that. I think the real question is, would that kind of ad have the same impact in the political, and I think we also have to say the fractured media landscape of the 2020s, when just because it's true isn't going to make it necessarily convincing.
Bruce and Dan, thank you both very much indeed.
Thank you. It's been a pleasure,
Adam.
Thank
you, Adam.
I was speaking there to Professor Bruce Shulman of Boston University and Dan Rowe of Oxford, two experts in the politics of the 1980s. Well, it's impossible to imagine a landslide victory for either party today on anything like the scale of Reagan's victory in 1984, not just because Reagan was a once-in-a-generation political talent, but because of the intense partisan polarization that makes 1984 seem in some ways as distant as the 1930s. It's worth remembering that even while Reagan swept all but one state in the presidential election, the Democrats still retained their majority in the House and won the popular congressional vote by a 5-point margin and picked up two Senate seats. So clearly there were millions of Americans in 1984 who happily split their ticket, voting for the Gipper at the top and for Democrats down ballot, something that is much, much rarer today. Yet, as Dan and Bruce were suggesting, perhaps for the benefit of hindsight, we can see in 1984 the outline of the political polarization to come. Jesse Jackson's assault on the racist and imperialist structures of power in America, Gary Hart's Clinton-esque triangulation, and even Walter Mondale's promise to raise taxes on the rich all have their echoes in the Democratic coalition today, and all are political positions that have generated intense opposition and reaction. And on the Republican side, alongside Reagan's sunny optimism, there was an undertone of resistance, of hard resistance to the cultural and social changes that by 1984 were already underway. You've been listening to The Last Best Hope, a podcast from Oxford University's RAI. And if you've enjoyed this episode, please leave us a review and download some of the 60 or so other episodes we've made. We keep these podcasts advert-free at the present, and so if you're able to make a donation to keep us going and keep us advert-free, we'd be incredibly grateful. Please go to www.rai.ox.ac.uk/podcast and click on the donate button. That's www.rai.ox.ac.uk/podcast. Our producer is Emily Williams, and I'm Adam Smith. Goodbye.